On behalf of Het Europa House or the European Parliament or the Information Office of the European Parliament of the Montesquieu Institute and Campus The Hague, I would like to welcome you here on the first debate that we are organizing this fall. The second one will be on December 7th, so I'm sure that will be interesting again, and if you've got your diary with you, it would be good if you jot that down. Today we're going to talk about the new media and democracy. And the question is whether or not new media are an asset to democracy. And one of my colleagues from another university than Leiden, but from University of Amsterdam, Andrea Schuk, is going to say some things about that. He specializes in media science, and he will probably want to say something more than just this about what he's doing, because I'm sure it's very interesting. So the talk will be about half an hour, and after that we'll have a discussion. And for those of you who haven't seen them before, the statements are on a piece of paper that you can find on your chair. I will be the chair during the discussion. I will just pick at random one or more of the statements that we will talk about. And when we do, then Andreas will first give his opinion about the statement, and then the room can just say whatever they like. One thing about the discussion, I would really appreciate it if not everybody starts yelling and shouting at the same time. We will have two of these microphones, so my assistant, my beautiful assistant Rhea, and I will walk in the room, and but I will be the one to decide who will ask a question. And if you ask a question, please make a short introduction and not an introduction plus one question and another one and another one and another one, because, you know, we hope that everybody here will have a chance if he or she wants to ask a question. So please, a little bit of discipline will make everything much more fun. And after about 45 minutes of discussion, you are all invited for drinks. So we will hope when we leave the room here and the building, we will all be very happy and walking very nicely. But for now, I would like to give the floor to Andreas to give his speech, and after that, we'll dive into discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Andreas Schuk. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Amsterdam for political communication. I'm actually particularly happy to be here and speak in front of a European Union group, because I actually spent 3 years of my life studying media effects on the outcome of the Dutch constitution referendum. So don't tell me if you voted no or nay in that referendum, but if you have any question how the media had an effect or not on the outcome of that referendum, I'm happy to talk to you afterwards. Why was I invited to be here today? Because my core interest is political participation and political mobilization and the impact of media on that. So not only new media, but also more traditional media. And in Amsterdam, we are kind of a large research group of people who all do research on the question, how is the European Union covered in the media, and what effect does that have on public opinion about Europe, or on voting in European elections or referendums, to give some examples. But I was invited today to talk about new media. And everybody, of course, loves the internet, and everybody is very excited about the internet. So just in the last 5 years, the number of internet users worldwide has doubled. So we now have more than 2 billion people who are online. We have some countries where, in fact, access to the internet is a legal right, such as Estonia or Finland or Spain. But we also have some big differences if we kind of look at the distribution of online access. So in Africa, less than 10% have online access, even though due to spreading mobile devices, we can actually assume that to change quite rapidly. But yet we see a large difference, of course. We have more than 71% of people in the developed countries, so-called developed countries, who are online, and only 21% in developing countries. So with this rise of internet access, a lot of hopes obviously came about with regard to how the internet could impact democracy. And obviously, it's a very short jump only to assume that with more people being online, it should also be possible to enhance democracy and strengthen democracy. And a couple of new media have kind of developed, or new platforms have developed to kind of foster this optimism. If we look at the Netherlands, we have reached a point of saturation, I would say, in the Netherlands a couple of years back. So we assume that now more or less 90% are online and are online regularly. This is obviously much more than the world average, which by now is about 30%. But what are these new kind of platforms that now everybody is so excited about, and which I am, of course, trying to challenge that they are yet so wonderful? A couple of things have had an impact, I would say. So on the first, we see that people, we have something like developed citizen journalism, so everyday people kind of contribute user-generated content to newsrooms. So basically, the boundaries between journalists and regular people seems to be kind of vanishing. We have a lot of blogs. 176 million blogs are usually tracked on the Nielsen company website. We have discussion forums with commenting functions. We have chat rooms. We have social networks, comment sections on regular news websites. So obviously the idea is that this is all good for political deliberation and contributes to democracy. And when we look at social networks a little bit more in particular, since they are in the title of today's session here, we know that 3/4 of young adults in the US are a member of one or the other social networking site. And in the Netherlands, even 98% of those people online below the age of 30 are a member of social networking sites. We also know that, for example, in the last Obama election, 1/4 of US citizens actually reported that they got news on this election on social networking sites. So all of this seems to kind of point to the relevance of this and seems to show that indeed these new forums are very influential. Couple of graphs. This is the growth of Facebook accounts. And as you can see, it stops in 2010. And not to shock you, it has actually almost doubled since then to September 2011. So we actually are now, latest numbers from last month, 712 million accounts. So as you can see, 1st of January 2010, this was had just cracked the 400 million. Now we have 712. That's a 12-month growth rate of more than 40%. We have growth rates in particular countries like Brazil from more than 300%, India 160%, Thailand 130%, and more than 150 million US citizens are on Facebook. A couple of more facts about Facebook. We know that half of Facebook users actually are logging onto their Facebook account every day. The average user has 130 friends, so you can now kind of check if you're popular or maybe not with this. There are more than 900 million objects that people interact with. Can be pages, can be groups, can be communities. We also know that every day 250 million photos are uploaded on Facebook. It's offered in more than 70 languages, and users have in fact contributed to these translations. And we know that 350 million Facebook users access Facebook also with their mobile phones, mobile devices. Very impressive. This is the number of Twitter users, new Twitter users a month. And as you can see, from 2008 onwards, we have a rapid increase. This is another chart that tells you that 44% of Twitter users joined between January and August 2010. This is the number of tweets per day worldwide. And also with regard to very particular issues, we see that Twitter has become quite relevant. This is, for example, a chart that shows the number of tweets per second when Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was killed. And you can see how it develops over the day. And at peak time, we have more than 5,000 tweets a second. That is kind of relating to this event happening. So significant traffic. But also in the Netherlands, if we look at the last elections, we can see that people tweeting about politicians, so mentioning their names or whatever sort of nicknames or abbreviation. I actually talked to people who have to identify nicknames of politicians and then make sure that these statistics are correct. So it's quite interesting nicknames for some politicians. But anyway, this is kind of the aggregated numbers, and you can see that in the last week of the campaign, the discussion on Twitter about the election also increased. You can also, actually, if you want to, get your daily news diet via Twitter. Just sign up, you know, for example, here, become a follower, and get your daily news diet directly via Twitter. Now, of course, these charts all seem to indicate that this is, you know, something really grand happening here, very dynamic, recent, and, you know, the numbers in absolute terms are already crazy, but the growth rates are even more crazy, so it also doesn't seem to stop. And, of course, a couple of other things that you all, of course, know a lot about, you know, that all contributes to this optimistic perspective that new media really, really matter today and today's democracy, was, of course, this groundbreaking a tool that Barack Obama employed in his campaign, the mybarackobama.com. I don't know if you signed up. I woke up and got emails from Michelle Obama personally addressing me, dear Andreas. I mean, obviously, you know, via a certain software. She was not really writing me. That would be troubling. But obviously, a kind of a new tool to organize and publicize campaign rallies, to build momentum, to build movement, what Obama was praised for so much, to organize fundraising, to organize online town hall discussion forums, to store information, and to retrieve information. But some people think that Obama was the first. That's actually not true. The first was Howard Dean in the election before the Obama election, 2003-04, who also already employed this forum, which I guess most of you don't know unless you're American, and even then you might not know it. But meetup.com was kind of the tool that Howard Dean in the election 2003-2004 already employed. And he didn't even do so much about it. It was more his supporters kind of taking this forum and organizing themselves to organize fundraising rallies, all these kinds of things. And the last thing, and of course I have to mention this, is of course the Arab Spring. Also here, the impression being that new media really, really matter. Where would we have gotten all these reports from if not via social media, Twitter, Facebook, all these tools, because obviously there was no regular coverage, you know, that could reach us here. So basically it seems kind of a suicidal enterprise now to tell you that social media are maybe not all that important after this build-up. Because obviously if we look at all these figures, at all these facts, they seem to be very objective and undeniable. And I think there is a common sense that even if you don't know much about these media, even if you don't subscribe to them and don't have a Facebook account yourself, there is a common sense that these things really seem to matter. But as I am from a university, I, of course, am interested in kind of empirical research. So basically, I think there is vast agreement that the normative potential of all these media is big. It's undeniable that they provide a forum for discussion, all the things that I already kind of alluded to. But the question now is, are there measurable effects of this? Is this actually more than just a promise? Is it also empirical reality that democracy has changed? That political participation has increased, for example. Is this really the case? So we have to distinguish between a more subjective sense of these new media are very effective, and the question, is there really an objective change in the way people are involved, the information they get, all these kinds of things. A quote of Matthew Hindman, who's a Harvard fellow and a professor at the University of Washington and quite significant in this whole debate, captures this quite nicely, and he says, too often normative debates about the internet have gotten ahead of the evidence. So what is the evidence? In very basic terms, we can distinguish between two perspectives here. The first perspective is basically the one that I started off with. So basically the idea that the internet will reform politics. And as a consequence of that, also redistribute political power, kind of giving it more into the hands of the people. And the idea that the internet or technology as such has the power to shape society and politics. The other perspective that where you also find researchers kind of picking up that blame would be that is entitled here as the normalized. So the idea that actually current political relationships will just be replicated online. So it might be that politicians make use of social networks, start Twittering, all these kinds of things, but that in the very end, actually not much will change. And the idea that basically, as with the introduction of every new medium, there is an initial hype, but actually not so much will change after. We can further distinguish this then a little bit. So here, the optimist perspective and arguments, because I now try to summarize a whole bulk of literature that is kind of picking up these claims. So these studies basically saying, okay, more people will get involved. That's very good. It will facilitate discussion. People will participate more. There will be more deliberation. So the quality of discourse is getting better. There's mobilization taking place. And it will all revitalize democracy because we're living at times with dropping turnouts in elections, all these kinds of things. So basically, the arrival of new media as being sort of a partial medicine for this dilemma that many democracies are facing today when it comes to citizen involvement. Then the pessimist perspective, which basically says, okay, it's not only that existing power relations are basically just repeated online, but since it's especially the young people and especially the smart people, the well-equipped people, this perspective even gets to a negative statement because it says, okay, it actually deepens the divide in society because some people are more quick to pick up technical innovations and others are kind of more left behind. They might also participate, but at a slower rate so that we actually have a democratic divide in the long run as a result of new media. And then we have the last perspective, which I here call skepticism, which is in between the first two. So it's less optimistic than the first perspective, but it's also not really saying that it's harmful what's going on right now. So this perspective would kind of say that it's all politics as usual. The internet does not destroy anything or leave anyone behind, but it does also maybe not change politics as we know it. So this perspective very much picking up claims that when television arrived or radio arrived, people got very excited about these new possibilities. But in the end, we just see things repeating. So basically, discussions now maybe taking place online, but it's still the kind of the same content with the same reach and so on. So we have these different positions now. You can all ask yourself already and equip yourself if you should be chosen randomly, as was announced in the beginning, in which of these camps you basically would place yourself. But since I started off with all these impressive numbers and figures, the question still is, how can one not be an optimist? Now that you have seen all these wonderful charts and everything is going up, 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 different to current stock market rates, it seems these numbers all go up. So let me start off by casting some initial doubt. This, what you see here, is the age of users of Twitter. I would be very impressed if we maybe have somebody above 55 here who actually belongs to this. Very good. To this, what is it? If you aggregate it, it's maybe 1% of Twitter users that are above 55. But more importantly, we have 80% of people being below the age of 30. We have comparable statistics for Facebook, where it's a little bit less, so it's 72% that is below 35. Admittedly, what one has to say is that we also have rather large growth rates in the older age segments. So it's not that this is written in stone, but we also see increases in the older age bracket. Nevertheless, it's a, I think, pretty obvious, not a normal distribution. Now, when we look at age, this is kind of asking people during the U.S. election in 2008 where they kind of got information about the campaign from, and if they watched campaign videos online. So these are data from the Pew Research Center. And what we see here that it's mainly in the age group between 18 and 29 where people say, okay, I use social network sites, and that is where I got information about the campaign. Same for online videos, so on YouTube. Coming to gender, we have a gender gap when we look at Twitter users. So as the cliche might already suggest, we do know that Twitter users are more male than female. We have the same difference in direction when it comes to Facebook, but much less. So the gender bias is not as big with Facebook. Excuse me? The cliche of basically, when I come to the pirate party in Germany later, which is a party that comes out of the internet kind of community, and it's 95% male. Sort of, yeah. I wanted to avoid the word nerd, but basically, yes. Then, with regard to geographic location, we see that although there are lots of twittering and tweets going around the world, also here the distribution is quite different and centered in certain parts of the world. So obviously this phenomenon is not one that is equally important or equally prominent around the whole world. And interestingly, when we look at who tweets, then we actually also see that we have some very active people and then a vast majority of people that only tweet very rarely. So actually 22.5% of the users post 90% of the tweets. So we have quite an active smaller group and a bigger group that is only occasionally tweeting. But this was just casting some initial doubt. And now you might wonder, who is this man? This is Aristotle, but he's just a shifter for letting science speak. So he obviously is not having to say anything about Twitter. But anyway, what do we now know when we look at actual empirical scientific studies? And I'm very happy to actually present some very, very fresh findings from colleagues of mine at the University of Amsterdam, which are actually so fresh that the paper is in press, so it's not even published yet, but I have the permission to tell you what they found. So what did they find? They conducted a representative survey in the Netherlands with more than 2,000 people aged 13 and above, and they wanted to know, okay, who is actually using blogs, Twitter, discussion forums, social networks like Facebook, who comments on news sites, and when people do they do that with political content or general content? So how political is, for example, Twitter use or Facebook use? And they distinguish between passive use and active use. So passive use would be that you just read a tweet, for example, or you join a group, or you watch a video, whereas active would be you produce. So you write, you publish, you comment. So this distinction is made in this study. And what they look for is, okay, how large is actually the share of the Dutch population that is actually involved in these kinds of networks. And what they find is the following. So when we first talk about general consumption, so that would be you don't produce and it's not about politics, then we actually see that there is quite some use of blogs, forums, comments, and social networks. However, looking at Twitter, for example, we see that only 6% of this representative sample in the Netherlands actually says that they read tweets. So this is not writing them or producing them themselves or commenting on them, just reading. If we then kind of ask how much of this is political, then the numbers drop quite a lot. What we only see is that about 20%, so 19%, read political comments on news sites. But of course, these numbers now further drop when we look at political participation, so that people actually actively produce something. And what we see here is quite high numbers for social networks or uploading photos and videos, but only 3% say that they have ever basically participated on Twitter, which means that they have produced something on Twitter, they have written something or they have commented something. And this is non-political, so this is general. And if we look at political, then we find that only 0.6% has actually said that they at least once a month sent a political tweet, so a tweet with a political reference or a content. And when we look at social networks like Facebook, it's 2.7% that has at least once a month done something that qualifies as political. This was defined in the questionnaire. I can talk about that later if you're interested in, so what is political. So these numbers are obviously, as you can see for yourself, very low. So basically what we're referring to here is social network participation political of 2.7% with 0.6%. My colleagues and I were actually very surprised when we got these data back, because if you consider how prominent this topic has become also in or as part of news coverage, in Amsterdam we just held a big debate on Twitter and politics, and we had politicians invited who talked about their experience with Twitter, then it is pretty striking how small, in fact, these numbers are looking at the general population. So what we can conclude from this study is that the majority of people is not consuming or participating in politics via Twitter or social networking sites like Facebook. Among those that are at least doing something, most only consume but don't produce, so don't actively participate. 77% of our sample said that they never or hardly ever read political content on blogs, tweets, comment sections, or what have you. And 94% of the sample say that they have never or hardly ever participated in any of these platforms when it comes to political content. Mind you, we already adopted a very lenient classification, once a month. That's already very low, in fact. So the numbers are even lower, of course, when you look at more regular use, like once a week. We also asked people why don't they become more active? We found that the main reasons were fear of privacy and the feeling that contributions have no effect, have no impact. So those were the two dominant reasons why people reported that they might read content on these sites, but they don't actively contribute themselves. Another reason was that we found that people said that they find the discussions uncivil. So that was another reason. This could, of course, change over time. We don't know. But for now, this seems to be another problem. There's also some other research outside the Netherlands analyzing contents of political blogs and discussions, and also concluding that there's not much deliberation in a Habermasian sense going on in most of us. In a Habermasian sense. In an ideal democratic idea of everybody can talk, there's no hierarchy, and so basically the high ideal of democracy. Another thing that this study also found was that those people who are involved are the usual suspects. So it's people who are already politically interested, have a strong sense of political efficacy, so they think they matter, they think they can have an impact, and they have some technical affinity. So this is kind of feeding into one of the three perspectives I presented to you. So the idea that it's not really the disengaged that are picking this up, but rather those who are actually already more engaged. What I should stress, of course, is that this is a Dutch study. It's actually the first study that uses a representative sample to look for answers to these questions. But we should, of course, be careful to generalize this and now talk about, you know, these results as being applicable to Europe or outside that. That's, of course, not possible. couple of other findings that I wanted to share with you. This is a pretty influential study in the field, kind of looking at social networking website and political engagement of young adults. So also using a survey among young voters in the US. And they basically also did not find very optimistic findings when it comes to political participation as a result of social networking site use. So people did not gain political information substantially through their use of social networking sites. It was conform with existing political views, what they came across. And they also showed that users of social networking sites are not more likely to participate in offline politics, but they are more likely to engage in online political activity, so in less traditional forms of political participation. These are the two gentlemen I just referred to, and this is basically their conclusion. Our sense is that the hyperbole surrounding new web developments as they relate to citizenship may be just that, a hype. In fact, it is reminiscent of earlier hopes for Web 1.0 and before that television and even earlier developments in mass communications technology. The contention that social networking websites will spur a democratic revolution may be overstated. Yeah, some last findings that also kind of tie into this more skeptical perspective. There are some studies looking at campaign websites and also the kind of functions on campaign websites to spur interactivity. And what they found was that the people visiting campaign websites, for example, were not significantly more engaged, and that only those people who are already pretty engaged are kind of further mobilized by this. So when we kind of tie this all up, we can maybe conclude something along the lines for this perspective, as Schäuble and Nisbet say here. So they kind of conclude the democratic potential of the internet is limited. They also show that using the web for entertainment purposes, which of course many people do, even shows that people become less trusting and less efficacious and less knowledgeable. And they conclude that traditional mass media maintain their key role in promoting citizenship. And to get those of you who are heavy Twitterers really upset, a last quote by a study basically saying, okay, this whole idea that journalism has changed so much and audiences have actually, you know, merged with journalists, that this is actually not the case. So journalists have remained journalists, audiences. So political news use on these websites is in fact not so widespread. So is it all just a myth is now the question. What I try to do now is, of course, follow ancient rhetoric, in fact, by Cicero, for example, who says, okay, first build a strong case and then debunk it and then kind of, you know, say why the first part was true nevertheless. Yeah, and that is, of course, now what I do to become friends again with those Twitter people who are now really upset in the audience. So is it really true that it's all so negative as I have just said, or maybe not? Well, there is, of course, some evidence that one should take into consideration and that also weighs in heavily. So we have some studies that basically say, okay, there are so many different ways to engage citizens in politics and let them participate in politics. And some of these are maybe not even so easy to measure in quantifiable terms. So as a matter of fact, these new media do provide access to news and more information. They can link candidates and citizens, they provide space for political discussion, and you can also get a sense of what's going on in public debate and public opinion. So this particular study here is not an empirical study, but they stress the importance to also consider the symbolic empowerment of people. So the sense of, well, maybe people don't go and vote more now that they have these new media channels. But they might actually have more of a sense of being a citizen and actually, you know, engaging in a dialogue. And that does not have to be something that, you know, must be measurable with quantifiable outcomes, basically. Nevertheless, there are some empirical studies that are more in this optimistic paradigm. So And they all basically stress that if there are effects, they might be indirect, but there might be some these indirect effects. So, for example, using new media can foster political discussion and civic messaging, and that in turn can influence political participation, so more of an indirect effect. There are also some studies that focus on how online discussions translate into political engagement offline. So first, basically, people meet online, discuss things, and this then actually also in a more indirect way results later on in more offline participation. And some studies stress that we have to distinguish much more in research, in empirical research, between the different sites. Because it's true that by now, this is a new research field, and very often studies kind of just merge this all together and say, you know, social media use, like how much do you use and how often? But given that they all have very different utility functions, some offer, you know, more discussion forums, others don't, it is actually relevant to distinguish and look at these individually. And some first studies have actually shown that then you come to different conclusions. Now, this is a last study I want to show you and then leave it with that. So this study was conducted in the Netherlands and was did a web survey and a web experiment. And it did show that people who use more social networking sites, that this might actually have a slight effect, not a very strong effect, but a slight effect to get people who are not so interested in politics a little bit more interested. They also show that viewing candidate profiles on social networking sites strengthens existing attitudes towards that candidate and may be interesting for politicians. I don't know if we have one in the audience, but politicians who actually react on comments of users are seen as more favorable. So basically they get a gratification by the citizen or by the voter for having responded, if you want so. Now, I first have kind of shown you the picture of a new media being very much on the uprise and apparently becoming very, very important or just being very important. Then I have been casting some initial doubt. Then I presented you some research findings that actually show, well, maybe it's really overstated. Then I have shown you a couple of findings that seem to indicate that there are some sort of effects, not very strong or direct, but nevertheless important. I now want to kind of conclude with stressing a couple of things that I think undeniably have in fact changed as a result of the rise of these new media, and that are, aside from the question, you know, do people now go and vote more, or do they kind of become more politically interested, that are maybe more grander general trends that we witness. The first one is that politics is changing in light of these developments. This is actually not new. We have seen this with regard to the emergence of other media just as well, but kind of once more getting back to the Howard Dean example that I mentioned a little bit earlier, who was, as I said, a candidate running for the Democrats in the 2003 primaries for the 2004 election. And it was not his idea to become such a new media candidate, but he was kind of made a new media candidate by his supporters. So he says, along comes this campaign to take back the country for ordinary human beings, and the best way you can do that is through the net. We listen, we pay attention. If I give a speech and the block people don't like it, next time I change the speech. Now, of course, I put this on because there is one of the Stellingen for today that is kind of referring to the question, is it dangerous? So I think we'll get back to that question. But as a response to this quote, we actually have a quote by a political blogger, Derek James, who says, I'd vote for SpongeBob SquarePants, that's a polite, friendly guy over on the right, over Howard Dean, but his campaign organization is being run in a very smart, very democratic way. So something we can, of course, discuss is if this, what we in science call mediatization, so that actually politics responds to developments in media, if that is a good thing or not. Is this actually you know, something one should want from a democratic perspective, that actually politics adapts to this extent? I mean, this is, of course, an extreme example. Or is this actually something we don't want? We have a quote here from Steve McMahon, who was one of the campaign managers to make the link to the Obama campaign, which is, of course, much more present, I think, for many here. So he says, the Obama for President campaign is what all of us hope Dean for President would become. Obama is Dean 2.0, dramatically updated to reflect the emergence of the grassroots. And I think the grassroots aspect is indeed one that is something that will remain. So you can all already sign up for the Barack Obama 2012 campaign. I already did, so I actually already now got my first email from Michelle Obama again. So it's already all up and running. But basically, the idea of the grassroots obviously was very prominent in the 2008 campaign. And I'll show you a couple of examples in a second that have nothing to do with Obama, how this, of course, now really sticks with us, I think. First here, this is not Dean's, but Obama's new media campaign strategist. So this is what he has to say. The Obama campaign prioritized the web because it provided access to the very heart of the organization, ordinary people. The campaign used the web to lower the barrier to entry for as many people as possible and develop relationships that turned those people into activists, donors, and leaders. And I think that is indeed something that was only possible because of new media and that will actually stick with think of the Occupy movement that I actually have been to a conference in Madrid and I didn't even know that Madrid is also big in the Occupy movement. But I actually woke up with people singing the Internazionale below my hotel window. And so a big event there in Frankfurt, in Germany, in many European countries and outside Europe, of course, too. So this kind of movement, of course, developed, I mean, would not be possible to think of this without the technical infrastructure that basically new media have provided. Of course, we can expect that most people who kind of set this up and who actually got active were politically active people before. But we can, of course, assume that, you know, a significant number of people, if we look at the number of people joining these demonstrations, have joined this and are maybe now more involved than they have been before. In Germany, and since that is my home country, please bear with the German language poster for a second. We have the already briefly mentioned Pirate Party, which is a party that was born out of a kind of a movement of internet, I don't want to call them activists, but people very, active on the internet, so I guess that makes them activists, who are who very much fought against a law that was supposed to be passed where they saw the their privacy being threatened. So basically, this party now has been running for the first time, not for the first time, but in a significant in significant terms for the first time, in the Berlin local elections and got 9% of the votes. I heard that you had Guido Westerwelle here 1 or 2 or 3 weeks ago. His party in that same election got 2%. And this party actually doesn't have much of a program. It doesn't even have much of a party structure. It doesn't. It has officially a party head, but it's they debate and negotiate their policies online without basically necessarily meeting and different people kind of determining the course of events at different times, depending on who's online. So this is really a party born out of the internet that kind of takes advantage of all these new possibilities. And, you know, obviously, this is a significant shift. At the moment, this party is predicted to gain about 6% of the votes in the next German national elections. That's above the 5% hurdle. I mean, again, Guido Westerwelle's party only has 3% at the moment. So this is pretty significant. Then, last point here, or second last point, of course, another thing that has changed with these new possibilities is, in a euphemistic, positive way, you could say there's more transparency now. You know, things are much more likely to come out. I don't know who knows this example, but we had the senator of Virginia, George Allen, who was followed by this young man, who was an activist for the opponent, and he took videos of speeches by this by the senator each and everywhere this senator went. He just taped it. And at some point, he lost his nerves, and he was shouting at this man, There you are again. Welcome to America, macaca. And that is a degrading word, basically referring to the non-American origin of this person. This has been watched by hundreds of thousands of people on YouTube. He lost the election by a very small margin. Of course, we can't, you know, scientifically claim that that was because of this event. But since the margin was very, very low, we might at least speculate, you know, what the impact of this has been. Now, again, from a democratic viewpoint, the question would be, you know, is this good that we actually get to see much more, you know, when we have people out there who actually tape everything? Or is this actually something that, you know, is not to be appreciated so much by all of us? Last point I want to make before I leave it up to you is that journalism changes. So not only politics changes, not only do we have new technical infrastructure that allows for all these kind of movements I just referred to, but what you of course also see is that journalists and the way journalists cover politics is changing. So we see, for example, a vast increase of using Twitter as a source. So journalists basically using Twitter sites of politicians. We also see that politicians and journalists use one Twitter account. They don't have a professional and a private account, very many of them, but this is merging too. And we just conducted an experiment at the University of Amsterdam because we were thinking that this new style of news reporting, that people would trust Twitter sources less because it's Twitter. But it's actually not true. It's actually not true. Twitter does not have lower credibility for people like the... And I mean, now again, don't think of your cohort, but think of your, you know, parents' cohort as well. There's no significant difference in the credibility people assign to statements that have been tweeted as opposed to other statements. Now, last chart, because I know that there are lots of Stellingen, and these are not meant to be Stellingen, but I at least want to let you know what are actually things that we... you know, who do research on this, kind of keep ourselves busy with in the upcoming time period. I think one very central question is, what is political participation today? Because all these studies try to show effects or non-effects of these new media on the way people participate politically. But obviously, you know, back in the days, political participation was voting, being a party member, these kinds of things. And when you look at the different studies, they have very different operationalizations of political participation. What is political participation today? When you buy biological food in Albert Heijn, is that already political or is it not? Is it civic engagement? Is it political engagement? So there's a confusion about these terms in the literature that also explains a lot of contradicting findings, because you have a lot of studies that, you know, are optimistic, a lot of studies that are come to very different conclusions. Second question, I think, is not yet settled. So who gets more engaged, and, you know, how do we assess engagement? So does it include people who kind of see these new media as alternative ways of getting involved? Or is it those who are already engaged in a more traditional sense? Then one thing is, what is talked about in all these forums? So you have to know that for a long time in communication science, we actually by hand read and coded the content of everything, of news coverage, of television coverage. So now there are, of course, smart people in informatics department, for example, who actually program or come to algorithms that allow us to analyze the content of blogs, for example, in a big scale in no time. So that is due to technical advances. It's possible to kind of come to a better assessment of how political, for example, is the discussion, or how, you know, much of a quality debate is taking place there, if you try to define quality, you know, in one way or the other. Then one point, the power of small groups. So I showed to you that apparently in the Netherlands, not a whole lot of people are very active, but there are some people that are very active. And there's, of course, some benefit to actually further look at these particular people and kind of also consider their outreach and, you know, the amplifying or multiplying function of their activity. And finally, we have almost no cross-national research that is actually trying to compare things across countries, across cultures. We know, for example, that obviously in countries where press freedom is more of an issue, we have higher growth rates of people signing up to social networking sites. So obviously where there's a demand, we have a bigger increase. So it could be that, you know, in some contexts, these sites are just not the right place to look for political content because it's just not necessary. Okay, if I'm not mistaken, I am at the end now. I would like to point you to the website of all of those people at the University of Amsterdam who do research on political communication. This is not just online communication, but also really voting behavior, very different topics. How is Geert Wilders covered in the media and with what effect? We publish all our results. They're all made publicly available on this website. So if you once in a while want to maybe visit that website, I hope that you'll find it a useful source. With that, I hand over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to change the program a little bit because it might be nice to give the audience an opportunity to, for 5 or 10 minutes, ask you some questions. Who would like to be the first? Who dares to be the first?
Thank you. I basically have two questions for you for your presentation today. The first one is about the duration of your research, your presentation. Another one is about the scope. In your presentation, I saw that you mentioned MySpace. MySpace is dying, if not dead. And you still mention that. And all of your quotes is without date. So I wonder,
what is it?
Without date, the quotes.
Without date.
Yeah. So have you ever thought about that from when? What was the duration of your research? Is it very dated or is it very updated? First question. Second question is about the scope. You mentioned like PVDR or Honglink, that you also considered opinions from the right of the political spectrum. Two questions.
What are you? Which one are you referring to with the letter question? I didn't get what you were referring to with the letter question. So
oh, the scope. The scope. On your presentation, you mentioned quite often, as we can see from here, you have PVDR, which is a Labour Party here in Netherlands. Another one is Honglink, even left, even lefter.
But that was just mentioned on one. One chart.
But I haven't seen you mention anything, the opinions from the right.
Well,
is that sort of imbalanced?
No, I mean, it was not about opinions of these parties. I think the chart you're referring to was showing how often people Twitter about politicians of these parties. So the chart that, because that's the only chart that actually carried Dutch party names, so I think you must refer to that one, actually also mentioned Geert Wilders. He was just less present. I mean, I can show it to you if you want, but I mean, they are on, it's a complete list of parties. But I mean, to answer your question, because I mean, some of you might now think that I get in defense mode, but I'm actually not. I mean, what you're saying is, okay, what's the duration and what's the scope of your study or of the studies that you present? A couple of comments to that. No study I have talked about is older than 2008. Now you might say 2008, you know, it's like developing so quickly. What's 2008? Well, the thing is that you have to consider the publication process in science, which is a kind of, you know, sometimes, no, I mean, actually the studies on the Obama elections are coming out now. They're coming out now. And that is because it takes up to 2 years until an article is reviewed, accepted, and actually put to press. So I don't blame for myself that what I present to you here today is the status of today. It's the status of today that we know. That is a subtle but important difference. And with regard to the scope, I completely agree with you actually that you know, much more should be done. But actually, what you have to see is that, for example, this study about the Netherlands was the first representative study on the use of these forums in the Netherlands. It's the only one I can present. It's not that I was lazy and, you know, skipped the others or they had findings that I didn't like or something. but I have to stick to what's there. But, you know, to end on a more optimistic or positive note on this issue, this actually makes it a great research topic. So, you know, if I look at the increase of panels at international conferences on this topic, it's incredible. Like the main conference in the field a couple of years ago had one or two panels on this topic. Now it's much, much more. And but I mean, some of the questions that I raised in the end are so interesting and so relevant. Like, for example, how to conceive political participation today? Like, does it make sense, you know, the way it's measured in these studies? Sometimes I think it's not, but then it's a great research field to actually come up with better solutions. But it's just not there yet. The field on this topic is much behind the popular discourse.
My name is Małgorzata Poskaczewska. I am a journalist and also I am editor-in-chief of the website of the Polish community here in the Netherlands. And at the very beginning, when you talked about three perspectives, optimist, pessimist, and skeptic, I thought I would be in the third group. But now I think I am more to the switching to the optimistic side of the spectrum. Because I think the speed of the change is quick, and what the internet is doing is mobilizing people, and ordinary people, grassroots people. So involving as a horizontal, and TV and radio, but not. You also get interaction from people. So I think the participation will be only increasing. But then everything goes about the quality of participation, and the content. But my second remark is, things are evolving very rapidly. There are new things happening. I will give you an example which struck me very much. As there are a lot of anti-Polish reactions on the Dutch websites, where there's an article on Polish migrants, there are a lot of, or the Telegraph, for example, there are already some, within one day, 200, 300, 500 reactions. Most of them are negative. So somebody suggested to me, let's make an action on the internet. And the meaning was, let's write as if we are Dutch, in Dutch, very positive reactions, you know, to have interaction within the readers of the posts. So it's something new. And I think in the near future, there will be even more and more, you know, innovation. So we cannot look into the future, but I think the impact will be very, very big. Thank you.
Yeah, I think what you describe, where you basically manipulate the comments, reminds me a little bit of booking.com and hotel.com. When you book a hotel, and you know that the hotels themselves write positive reviews of their own hotel, and then the angry responses. But no, it also opens up new research fields. For example, what we started doing is we were so far always interested in how does news content affect political attitudes, opinions, behavior. But we now have, for example, launched one study where we basically test the effect of comments to news articles on readers to kind of see does that have an impact on how people think, so that basically citizens affect citizens rather than the media, having an impact on citizens. So you're right, it's of course a very dynamic field. And some of these things to research, you can hardly foresee because the development is so fast. I'm also not in the pessimist fraction. I think I'm in the skeptic fraction, leaning towards a positive outcome.
My name is Bruno van den Elshout. I'm a photographer. Thanks for the interesting presentation. I wonder how much of your research can actually be valid if the underlying definition is still under debate, the one about what is political participation. I think it's very difficult to make resounding conclusions if that basic point is not clear. I also wonder, you qualified the graph of Twitter by age cohort as abnormal. I'd be very curious to see an overlay of the age distribution of people participating in the French Revolution. It may sound very abstract and far away, but I think it shows remarkable similarities. Then I wonder how much use of social media was actually applied while collecting the data. If you have been using social media to conduct this type of research, and the third question would be, where can I follow you to stay updated?
Three questions. Let me respond. Yeah, I mean, I brought up the political participation issue myself. So I think, you know, the thing is not that these studies are not valid. The thing is that you have to kind of see how a study has operationalized this concept and then kind of, you know, interpret it accordingly and not kind of, you know, come to grand conclusions saying, you know, these media work or they don't work with regard to participation. But you have to be very clear and also, you know, in when you communicate about this, like what is kind of then meant with participation. So in most of these studies, there's a distinction between political participation, which is more like traditional, old school, I go vote, I'm a member of something, I sign a petition, and then kind of more civic engagement, which are, you know, things you do online, you know, you pass on an email, you know, with a certain content or these kinds of things. But I think, you know, as long as you're clear about how within a particular study it is defined and how that relates to others, I mean, that's just all you can do. I'm not in the, I don't have the power to say from now on, folks, follow me, political participation is this, and now for all times it's clear. That is how research works, that, you know, there's a debate, there's a discussion, and in the end, you know, there will be standard measures, but they're not there yet. Should we stop doing research until that moment? No, because we will not get to a solution if we stop. Before you intervene, second point, French Revolution. Yes, absolutely. The chart with the age distribution was, of course, meant to say that this is a young phenomenon, which is not bad. Like, why would it be? I mean, in fact, it's good because the biggest concerns we had democracy-wise was always that young people are not more involved. So in a way, you know, you can almost say it's good news that, you know, if there's something happening that maybe has a slight effect, well, then it's good that it's happening in that cohort. Nevertheless, it's not evenly distributed, which is not meant to say that it should be or has to be. It's just something to take into account when we think of the reach or the scope of the phenomenon we're talking about. And last point, we have, of course, not conducted this study via social media. That's what people do, you know, for a BA thesis because they don't have money to collect data, and that's completely fine. But this is was collected as a representative sample. It was computer-assisted web interviewing. So basically, to include also people who have no internet access, like these. What was that? What was the point? What doesn't make sense? It's a representative sample. Of course, it makes sense because if you only ask people who already are using these things,
I don't say anything.
That's a biased sample.
I don't say anything about only.
But it's a representative sample. It's just by basic rules of statistics. No, it does. It does. It's representative of the Dutch population. Because, you know, the problem is that most kind of small-scale studies kind of ask people from the age of like 18 to 25, and they conduct the survey on Facebook. That's rubbish. That's big rubbish. What you have to do is, if you really want to get to conclusions about, you know, the overarching kind of scope of this phenomenon, you have to also include my grandmother, and you also have to include people, you know, who are not young and technically savvy and, you know, have five email accounts. And they are, but they are included. It's a representative sample. It's just by laws of statistics.
Well, maybe this is something to discuss about when we're having a drink. So I've had a number of people from this side of the room, but I would like to ask one person from the other side of the room, otherwise we get more remarks about left and right, and I don't want that. Anybody here who has a question? Yeah?
You're walking towards me, so I'll ask.
Well, if you want to.
Have you ever heard of Marshall McLuhan?
Sure.
Because it may be useful to integrate that in, but maybe it's also for the drinks, maybe to discuss. Because it's a long story. Because he basically is talking more about how media is influencing us on a psychological cognitive level. And then that's a step in between, and after that you get the actual political influence.
It's a McLuhan perspective on this.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
All right then, no more questions. Now we'll go and really fight. No, I would like to start with the statements. Well, time is time. The statements, there are 8 in all, and some of them are very negative about new media and some of them are very positive. And since we talk about new media and democracy, and I think in democracy elections are an important thing, I would like to start first with the first one. General elections once every 4 years do not give the electorate adequate opportunity to influence policies. Andreas, do you have an opinion about that?
Yeah, although I wonder if I should kick off, or if maybe...
anybody else?
I have a strong opinion on that, but,
yeah.
But I don't want to...
Okay, well, since the room doesn't say anything, maybe you should kick off. Where? Okay.
Well, I think in democracies and in non-democracies alike, at this moment, governments and politicians are looking at the internet, and because it's a very direct channel of citizens' voices. So in that sense, they use it. But to implement it in a more systematic way of referenda online, I wouldn't see that happening, and there's no need. But definitely on the substance, there is a great involvement through the internet. So
what I understand from what you say is that if you use new media, that would be an added thing to the, let's say, traditional way of for politicians to find out what the population or the electorate wants. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's a media channel, but more from the citizens up. So it's the grassroots way that you already talked about. And you can see it with things like Occupy Wall Street. It responds on new circumstances even before there's new elections. And politicians take it into account, even into new elections.
Mm-hmm.
So it all, it's part of new media culture. But yeah.
What is your opinion about the statement? Do general elections not give enough opportunity?
Well, it was never like that, but no. So no.
Okay, anybody else with a different opinion?
As I read this statement, general elections once every 4 years. So what you suggest, if we have had general elections once in 2 years, so the frequency will be,
more
influence.
I
would oppose that, of course.
I wrote once every 4 years because officially when everything goes normal, it's every 4 years. But the main idea is more or less general elections don't give enough.
General.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think general elections are the means to influence policy. You could do it another way. So I would look for another instrument.
And could new media be that instrument?
Yes, if people participate.
Okay. But that's the same thing with general elections. If people participate, then... So that condition is always there, is that correct? Or
general elections don't give a good opportunity to... Well.
See, you just introduced a condition saying if people participate in using new media, then that can be an added instrument. But doesn't the same thing apply to general elections in general? I mean, if people don't participate in general elections, how representative are they? And how much influence can they really have? If, let's say, only 38% of the electorate goes and votes, what about the other... Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, there was a gentleman in the back, and then you'll be next.
Thank you. Well, I'm a party member of D66, and we at D66 believe in referenda a bit more.
Yeah.
Not all the time, of course, but yes, maybe some that could be introduced more. Look at Switzerland, for example. They have it more. It's more democratic. Maybe a good thing to introduce. And what I would like to add, in the past, you have, for example, the party Trots op Nederland, I'm proud of the Netherlands. And what they did, they had like a poll on several issues, and then like the members could vote on what they believe on it. But I think that failed really already fast. So, yeah, I'm not really sure about the influence of internet on it, but on referendum, maybe a bit more.
But you could of course imagine a referendum through the internet. Yeah. Just to name something. Yeah, then you get the same thing like we had with DigiD, of course. Yeah, that's the problem. All right. Okay, the lady there on the second row wanted to say something.
Well, no, I'm Astrid Delis. I was just wondering why all the statements are related to the electorate. What about a new, not yet born or just born democracies? But there is not yet a electorate, only in the street, huh? like in the Middle East. That's not part of the discussion.
Well, of course, we're talking about democracy, and what you're talking about is not countries that are democratic. But I think we've all seen that, and I think Andreas hinted at that
yes,
all the changes happening at the moment, which we call the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. there the new media played presumably an enormous role, and then it could help.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And maybe we have the situation there now, like the new media brought about changes, and now we have to wait if the traditional way of having a democracy in those countries will work the way we hope it will. So it's just the other way around. Okay. Anybody else? Right then. Okay.
Basically, general elections, they are not enough for the electorate to influence policies, but there are other means that the electorate can use, based like petitions or like demonstrations. So like this, people can influence policies, but most of the people don't really use it. So kind of bias.
So my question to you would then be, if people don't use it, if people don't go and vote in general elections, if the people don't use any other means they have in between the elections, whose responsibility is it then that we sometimes say democracy doesn't work? Is it the politicians, or is it the people that should be voting or should be using those other means?
I think that's basically... that could be a vicious cycle as well, because people, they think they can't influence it. If you tell them, oh yeah, you sign the petition or participate in demonstrations, they think, what does it bring? Because I can't really do anything about it. But in fact, they could, but they just don't use the opportunity. Mm-hmm. So it's, of course, it can be more influenced through media as well. You could use new media to influence that, but how many people then use those new medias to actually, we heard it's not many people who use it to inform themselves about politics, so.
Yeah.
It's quite difficult.
Yeah, it is. All right, let's go to another statement. Number three, new media create hypes in politics, cause short-term thinking, and have negative influence. Who wants to say something about that? Okay.
You were all right. I just have a very short opinion about that. I think I'm not quite sure about the answer, but for all of this phenomenon of this new media, sounds to me it's like populism or activism. What exactly is that? Like everybody just go frantic on the street and then they force the politicians to listen to them. It's a sort of democracy we're talking about here. Should we just listen to like a bunch of, if you want to call it mob or the opinion on the street, and you form something that we think, okay, that's valuable. What is the distinguishment between the two then? The real democratic procedure, or those people who shout, or who occupy the space? I'm not saying that it's not wrong or bad or good or what, but everyone has their rights to present their opinions, and that's democratic. But the thing is, if we just listen to those people who occupy the street, who shout loudly, and then what's the true debate? Can people still calm down and think about, okay, what is real truth there we are pursuing? And that's actually my question.
Yeah, well, the point of, I think, the point that I try to make here is, when, at least that's my opinion and my impression, if you watch Dutch TV, the news bulletins, and all those other programs, especially late at night, those presenters always bring up, this has been on the internet, that has been on Twitter, and what's your opinion about that? And all of a sudden, politicians are forced to use or to comment on that and make promises. And the question is then, the promises they make, are they for long-term policies? Because that's what they were really voted for when they were voted in office. They have to govern the country, and they have to balance everything. And if they are forced by new media and by journalists who use them, they have to give answers to short-term things that happen and that may, after all, in the end, after some time, not be that bad as they are presented in, for instance, the new media. So the problem I think there is that we have to be very careful in our reactions to new media, to hypes, etc., etc.
The funny thing is that this is now, for example, exactly kind of within this skepticism, not pessimist, but skepticism paradigm, where people say, you know, we had the exact same discussion that politicians, you know, are pushed by newspaper coverage or television coverage, simply by, you know, public opinion as it is presented or established, you know, through the media. Politicians have been criticized for, you know, just kind of, you know, adjusting their policies or their statements to a media pressure, but already before the new media hype, or however you want to call it. So while I might, you know, agree with you that, you know, I'm not sure about the scope of the problem, but it's not a new problem. I mean, this is the same debate we had, you know, also with regard to more traditional media. So it's not inherent to new media. You know, of course, now that's the battleground on this issue, but it's not new. What would you say, for example, about Tony Blair going on war in Iraq against basically the vast majority of his country? And he exactly took your position. He said, hey, I was elected. I have a vision. I say this is the right thing. All the mainstream media were writing against going on war. All the public opinion was against going on war in the UK. But Tony Blair said exactly that. For some reason, I have the feeling you don't want to identify with that position. Then it was so, but no, but it's an interesting discussion, I think, you know.
Well, that's what he said, eh? And I think that's what he also said in his presentation, that the problems we see now with social media are just more of the problems we also saw with the so-called old media. So what's new about the social media or the new media? But there's one other guy who wants to ask a question.
Yeah, I want to support you in saying that the old media is definitely also creating hypes. If we're looking at your question or your statement, then it's threefold. First, new media is supposed to create hypes in politics. Second, it creates short-term thinking. And third, it has a negative influence. Third one is a very broad one. I will not go into that. The first one, it creates hypes in politics. I think if we look at the 24-hour news cycle, which was around before news media, CNN, Fox News a bit later, they have to have something to argue about. So this is making hypes necessarily, and it has nothing to do with new media. Actually, new media creates the opportunity to delve deeper into a subject rather than on the surface creating conflict where there might not be any. Okay, on the short-term thinking, it will facilitate short-term thinking, perhaps, but it also has the ability to create a long-term conversation on ideas, which is, I think, very interesting on looking at your investigation, because you're looking at political participation in social media, Facebook, Twitter, and I assume you're looking for political parties, support for political parties or candidates. And I think what is happening a lot around the internet is that ideas travel rather than support for a certain political party or a certain candidate. So what you what your research looks at is a very limited offer of political ideas. And the internet facilitates ideas across the board and a conversation about these. So if, for instance, someone publishes a Facebook message of a Christian preacher having a great idea and epiphany and talking about it through Facebook in certain networks, it will go around. In other communities, it will have a, for instance, you have the examples of atheist videos that go around Facebook and are replicated more and more. So that is not necessarily inherently a political subject, but it is an idea that has a lot of influence on politics, I would say. Negative influence, I'll leave that.
That's all right. He can ask one more question, but that's the final one you can ask.
Well, I think it's about, like, can you, Mr. Andrea Schacht, like, if you can just distinguish between the old media and the new media. You say that this debate is nothing new in the old media, or you have the same thing. Maybe they create hypes, and they also force the politicians to have the shows cited opinions because they have to respond to them. But let's put it this way. For the short term, like this short-term thinking, is that not necessary? I mean, to respond to those really urgent cases, it's not necessary then.
What do you mean it's not
necessary? It should be necessary, right? Because it's short-term. For the urgent case, and you need a short-term answer to that to quen them down.
Well, my reaction would be that, as these two here said, these two gentlemen, a politician should have a clear view of what he wants to achieve. So he has to go through long-term thinking. And my fear is that if you say that there is a short-term problem that comes up through either the old or the new media, then larger problems are divided into smaller things. And that has the risk that you lose the overall picture. And then you only try to find a solution for the small little bit that may not be that important on the long run. And when politicians react to that, they tend to spend a lot of their time dealing with those short-term small problems, while they should spend more time with the long-term problems. I know, because those people sit on those blue chairs in the second chamber and they want to stay there. And the more exposure on the media, whether they're old or new, they get, the better it is. Of course, all media have any kind of effect, whether good or bad. But you see that a lot of politicians like to have exposure. So, on the other hand, that's at least that's my opinion, that new media offer them an opportunity to get on the TV and in an interview and give their opinion, and they can say, oh, I've been on the TV again. So it has another meaning for them as well, not just you have a long-term vision of on what you want to achieve, but also I have to be visible to my electorate because I want to be re-elected after 4 years or 2 years or whenever the elections are. And that's inherent in the political process. But at the same time, they have to look at the long-term problems and the long-term solutions.
of everybody, the behavior has changed. If you look in the old media, the newspapers, I mean paper, in paper, look at what happened to NSC Handelsblad. It's full of photos and short articles. 10 years ago, you had huge articles, deep analysis, and they are all gone. So this is the impact between a new media and old media. And, okay, old media have their own hypes, and they are still hypes. Each age has its own hypes. But new media is the new engine. But on the other side, also incubator of new ideas. So it's on the positive side. But the question would be about short-termism. How do we see to that, that not only politicians, but all of us keep thinking about long-term issues?
What's your opinion about that?
Well, I think what you're referring to is that, I mean, simply the turnaround has gotten much, much faster. I mean, I remember in the 80s when I was a child, at 8:15 in Germany, it was the Tagesschau, and that was the one event in the day where you got your news. And of course now, and I think that is like what, you know, some of you are referring to now, is that the speed has just gotten much faster. But, I mean, that's unstoppable. I mean, kind of picking up one thing that I'm not sure you meant, but I think you meant, is that we, of course, like this division between old and new media will not make so much sense anymore pretty soon, because, you know, we have this big media integration development that, you know, people watch their evening news, you know, recorded with their mobile device on the train and so on. So what is then old, what is new? I mean, is television then still old in a traditional sense, or is it actually becoming a, you know, doesn't it have the same utility function that, you know, now so-called new media have? And what is it then? Is it a new old medium? Or yeah. So I mean, this distinction doesn't make much much sense anymore. But it's a process that that won't stop. So yeah. I mean, we can all think about, you know, how to deal with this and what politicians should do. But it's irreversible. But the problem is, if there's news popping out basically every second through these new channels. Yeah, I mean, kind of as you say, there is a need to respond, and there's a possibility to respond because politicians use the same channels. So it's, of course, there's a very, like a much quicker interaction. It's not that, you know, there's like something happening on Tuesday and then a response on Thursday, but you can respond publicly within minutes or seconds. Mm-hmm.
Okay. If I could, you have the floor.
Yeah, if I could respond, like with short term, they mean issues like in the Netherlands, in the parliament right now, they're discussing the case of one immigrant, and they're discussing whether one case is correctly brought before the judge, and that is not the things they should be discussing. They should be discussing broad outlines, and that is the problem that we look at. Here. So that is what we mean with short-term thinking, which we should prevent. But in a way, actually, social media actually also provides us with a way to circumvent this, because we don't no longer have this constant stream, which we don't really control, of media. But now we can be much more selective and then click on the next one and dig into it deeper. That's what you said already. And get into archives. And so information becomes much more flexible. And therefore, it doesn't have to be this superficial stream, like we said before.
All right. Well, we're almost done now. And I would like to raise one final thing that probably underlays the relation between the media and the politicians. I've once heard somebody describe the relation between politics and media as a marriage, mutual dependent. Is that true?
Which statement are you referring to with that?
No. It's a bigger one, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about democracy and politicians and the media. We're talking about new media, but also about old media. And if you study media and politics, at least when I was studying political science, there was this idea that politicians are depending on the media But the media are depending on the politicians as well, and they're mutually dependent. So they need each other. And is that really true? What is your opinion about that? And how independent are the politicians and how independent are the media?
Well, I mean, I mentioned this mediatization term before. I mean, what we have seen is that every time there is kind of a technological advancement, politicians respond to that. For example, think of sound bites. Like a couple of years ago, we know that the average length of a quote on television was much longer than it is now. So politicians know that journalists want short sound bites, so they have adjusted their language. There are studies that show how politicians have adjusted their language so that it's more likely that their quotes are picked up, so they are short and more to the point. And so now you can say, well, is that good or bad? So politics obviously depends on the journalists in that respect, and they kind of respond to media logic. Guido Westerwelle, who was here apparently, he was famous in Germany because he printed the goal of his party on his shoes and went to a talk show where he had studied the camera angle, and he knew that the shoe would be in the camera. So it said, like, I think the party logo, or 18% or what he wanted to achieve. So yes, politicians respond. Ideally, we have this idea, we want politicians with vision, as we said. But I mean, I think we also don't want politicians who are completely independent of what's going on. So in a way, I think, yes, it's a marriage. Yes, I think we want politicians to be sensitive to also what's going on in the media. But of course, there are lines and where it gets problematic when, you know, journalists and politicians befriend each other on Facebook and are pretty far away from the old ideal. And I mean, what we witness in journalism right now, which is of course interesting, is that, for example, these old norms of like fact-checking, you have to first have like two or three independent sources before you publish something. This is of course all kind of now with new media kind of eroding, because how often do you now see like little fragments where it says a source unknown, but we think this is in Syria. See how this guy is slaughtered. We think we got this on the internet. So, I mean, the whole relationship, of course, has changed. Journalism has changed. Politics is trying to respond, and it's a complicated marriage, and one that's dynamically changing. So I wouldn't be able to predict how it looks in 5 years.
Maybe just like any other marriage we know.
Yeah.
All right.
No divorce possible.
No. Okay, you're the very last one.
My name is Steven Kruiswijk. I'm a philosopher from The Hague. I just was looking on the Wikipedia page for Montesquieu. I don't know his work personally, but I read here that he understood or thought that each historical event was driven by a principal movement. So for instance, if Caesar and Pompey had not worked to usurp the government of the Republic, some other men would have risen in their place. And that these kinds of historical things, we are talking now in terms of, can we pin down something on social media? Is that something that's important or not? But wouldn't you agree with me also that there's some kind of bigger principle movement going on here? And could you give us your thoughts on what that might be, this bigger principle movement?
But do you mean a bigger principle movement in terms of that things change different than they were usually changing? Or?
Well, yeah, my own feeling is that we are approaching some kind of point, you know, that there's this very explicit breakdown of normal society, that the political processes in the Netherlands on their own have become very, very problematic, and you know, there's all these difficulties in even, you know, putting together a government, and then you have all the economic troubles that are not going away. You know, we are approaching some kind of a point of no return, it seems. So, do you agree? And do you? I like this Montesquieu idea that there's this bigger principle movement that's not really pinnable to one or thing or the other, but it's, we're in this together, and we're approaching like this milestone.
Well, that's, I mean, it is of course now a very grand question, maybe, you know, beyond the scope of this discussion, but I would say, you know, if I try to bring in the, you know, what the topic is of today, namely new media, then I would say if something like that would be there, and I think the contribution of new media would again be that the speed is kind of, you know, facilitated through that. So I mean, I think that would be the role that new media kind of would play in that, because, you know, think of you mentioned the economic crisis. You know, the cycles, you know, to come to political decisions was much longer than it has been now. I sometimes go to bed and I wake up and the government has met and it's so I think, you know, the contribution of new media in what you describe, if it's there or not, would be the speed, and in that sense it would be.
All right, yes. We have to finish now. So I would like to thank Andreas for being here and also you for being here, and I'm going to give you something.
Oh. Very nice. Thank you. Ashinas is my favorite
wine. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks for your attention.
I have to say one more thing. We're organizing a lecture series about immigration policies in the Netherlands in November and December, so the folder is on the tables there. And you can also subscribe to our newsletter, the Hofvijver, and there's also some folders on the table. So at least look at them, because then I don't get any angry looks from my assistant.